You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville. This is news team correspondent Gary Leonard, and I am joined in the studio today with the editor of the Asheville Blade, David Forbes. David, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be back.
And David, it has been a while since you and I have had a chance to discuss the city council meetings, meetings that you attend every time there's a city council meeting.
Yes, and you about also, every 2 weeks, yeah.
Every 2 weeks, and then you also write about via Asheville Blade, and so I'm excited to jump in and get things started. So as in the case of a lot of these city council meetings, there's typically some context before the meeting, and there was a budget discussion prior to this Tuesday city council meeting. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Certainly. So this is part of an ongoing debate over the city budget, and starting a lot earlier this year and even into last year.
That's a good thing.
Yes, potentially. So last year, the vote on the city budget was the closest it's been in a very, very long time. It was only passed by a single vote.
That's right.
A lot of public backlash over what was bluntly just an almost complete lack of transparency, especially on, you know, the budget presentation was a few minutes, for example, the official presentation. A lot of it centered kind of around avoiding ongoing public backlash around a really controversial plan to expand policing, especially downtown.
That's right.
And those concerns are what kind of that floundered on. But after that, the public backlash was so considerable, the city did say, look, we're going to start our presentations way earlier. You know, so there's going to be more chance for public input. But even our new city manager, Deborah Campbell, has criticized that process a little bit, saying she doesn't feel there was enough public input, especially among, you know, groups that aren't, you know, that have traditionally been more marginalized, that have traditionally not shown up for these city processes. And also notably, like at these budget presentations that have happened last year and into this year, there's no chance for public comment. So that's kind of cuts off a venue. And so staff do kind of still control, like, a lot of the narrative of it. And there are some concerns over that. And we'll see, you know, if people feel like that's being corrected going forward. But nonetheless, the fact that it is starting so much earlier does give us a lot of information we don't normally have. This time, the presentation was on what are called capital projects, which is basically city speak jargon for buildings, land, infrastructure, sidewalks, things like that. So this is a real issue in Asheville. Asheville was a notoriously debt-averse city for many decades. And, you know, as, for example, like the last attempted bond, which we just passed
That's right.
We just passed one back in 2016. Before then, the previous one was in the 90s, and it failed. And Asheville had, in the kind of the decades when it, you know, by everyone's account, didn't have, you know, a huge, you know, there was no tourism trade, essentially, that had a lot of poverty and still does, but the city just kind of let infrastructure languish. And so basically the city is, and didn't have much money to deal with it anyway, so the city's kind of paying for that now, as it were. And this has been a problem for as long as I've been covering council, which has been 13 years, and probably well before then. The city infrastructure is aging. The city doesn't have a huge amount of revenue to regularly replace it with. And these capitals projects are the sort of thing where generally cities will go into some debt. They'll take out a loan. So for big stuff that's like that, our bonds, like the ones that they passed via referendum, they legally have to go to the people and say, do you approve this, yes or no? But even with that bond money, it's still just kind of making a dent, according to the city. So city staff laid out that, look, there are $330 million of things we need. And that's everything from a new transit maintenance facility to keeping up with aging sidewalks to, you know, getting Asheville's roads are very nearly being considered failing under the criteria that traffic engineers use. And even the city bond funds only boost that up a little bit. So now the last, you know, council or two has been less averse to some of these, you know, measures. But I even remember the current mayor, Esther Mannheimer, you know, I talked to her, you know, 4 years ago, and she just ruled out bond funds at all. So it's really interesting to see the city shift and say, look, we will occasionally go to the voters. The city budget or CFO, Barbara Whitehorn, has, you know, kind of pointed out, look, a lot of bigger cities do this every 3-4 years. There'll be a bond for some big picture projects. That's where we go. Nonetheless, it does. Whitehorn also said that there's a lot of focus on equity, as like a lot of these funds for infrastructure the city is spending right now are being spent in neighborhoods where poverty is a major issue. But we know for a fact it's, for example, some of those funds are going around the River District, which is near and, you know, overlaps with, as actually considered once in a lot of cases, Southside, which is a historically African-American neighborhood. And there's been the Blade actually did a story a while back called Running Dry, which is a deep look at how, you know, yes, the infrastructure is being spent in area where there has been a lot of poverty and a lot of neglect of the infrastructure, but there's massive questions over where it's going. Is it going to things that are gentrify this more, right, to tourist attractions, while right down the road, you know, the communities have been there for a long time, been really hit by redlining, really don't get many resources. The city, of course, isn't spending $330 million. That's almost twice its annual budget. But it is kind of the city staff looking at this as kind of naming the scale of the problem. And gotcha. I think council kind of took it that way, too. So really, I think going forward, you're going to see them tie this list of these projects they supposedly have to do. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, they might try to get federal grant money for some of them, or they might go back to the voters again. But it is kind of, once again, you're seeing this council take a tilt at, like, how do we solve infrastructure? Because it's such a concern here, and it's only going to be more of one.
So, David, I have a quick question regarding the bond money. So the referendum that was on the ballot in 2016.
And passed overwhelmingly.
Correct. That was passed. You mentioned some of those capital projects in which the bond money can go towards.
Yes.
Has any of that happened in the 3 years that we have had this?
So, and the city actually, to their credit, has set up something you can monitor where these projects are.
Okay.
Some of them are still down the pipe. They are still, for example, that $330 million doesn't include affordable housing. That's a whole separate thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, regardless of what one's views are and the best way to deal with that, I think everyone acknowledges that it's a massive issue and the city will need to spend real resources to have any hope of dealing with it. But so, yeah, some of them started, some of the sidewalk stuff started pretty early. The stuff the city said in their terms were shovel ready. They'd already planned out. They just needed more funds to deal with it. As a matter of fact, later on, they debate using some bond money for, you know, some dealing with some softball field stuff. The bond money went to is going to traffic infrastructure, housing, and parks and rec.
Okay.
So you're seeing that come up bit by bit, but we're still in the early stages of it. There's going to be 2021 is when the city said, like, they expect things to kind of crest, as far as that's when really the, you know, shovel starts hitting the pavement and most of these projects really get built.
Great. Thank you for that clarification.
Of course.
And I believe that we are shovel ready now to really dive into this meeting that took place on February 12th.
Which was very short, yeah.
Yeah. So typically, as we've done this before, David, we kind of just breeze through the consent agenda. However, there was one piece that came up regarding the passenger rail. What's up with that?
Yeah, so this is actually really important. There's been speculation about passenger rail for, you know, as long as I've been in Asheville, longer even. So the last passenger train left Asheville in 1975. But obviously Asheville remains, you know, a spot where there's still a fair amount of rail infrastructure. You know, a lot of other goods, especially coal, pass through here. And, you know, there's the train tracks cut through right through a good part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been speculation for years about, hey, what if we could get passenger rail back here? And there's even been some speculation about, you know, according to the Asheville Chamber of Commerce at one point in the early 2000s, Asheville, and definitely since then, Asheville is the city most requested from Amtrak's agents. The people go to them, and this is the city they most want to take the train to.
Yeah.
But we don't have it here, at least not, you know, officially. Yep. You know, as you know, there have been itinerant artists and travelers who've taken trains in, but definitely not officially passenger rail. So with that, there is kind of a push now to kind of rekindle that.
Yeah.
The push in 2003 actually got a fair amount of leeway. A lot of the infrastructure along what would be the route from Asheville through West North Carolina, so through places like, you know, Marion and Morganton and some other, you know, Old Fort, some of the potential infrastructure was actually renovated.
Wow.
There. And as far as, like, places that can be used as stations and things like that. But then we had some massive flooding in the early 2000s, and then the recession hit when the funds recovered from that. And that's kind of the narrative laid out by former state representative Ray Rapp, who was there to kind of make this case. And he went a little bit of length, but he did provide some really important history about this. And this is kind of an interesting issue because it's something where you see, you know, it was one of the only issues, frankly, where you'll see, like, the city's Chamber of Commerce, but also, like, multimodal transportation advocates, like, kind of on the same side.
Mm-hmm.
I think their visions, once it actually, if it actually had been planned out, would differ pretty considerably.
Sure.
But as far as basic idea of we need alternatives to cars in Asheville, and from, you know, the business side, passenger rail is attractive to tourists to some degree. And it definitely does make travel easier if people are coming from, you know, hubs like, you know, Chicago, New York, places like that. Some of these major cities that never lost passenger rail. Nonetheless, there would be a lot that have to be done. Basically, what the city's trying to do is endorse this larger push, and the push trying to get all these towns along this route to say, look, we're ready to do this again and go with it again. And Amtrak is apparently more receptive than they have been to really putting some time and resources into this. So the city unanimously passed this and endorsed it. Counselor Keith Young said, look, I used to ride Amtrak when I was in college. It's a really affordable way to get around.
Yeah.
So really a fair amount of enthusiasm. We'll see if it works out. The first step would actually be an Amtrak bus line from Asheville to Salisbury, which is the nearest current station that's active for passenger rail, and also where any eventual line would go from Asheville down to Salisbury. So we'll see what happens, but it definitely it kind of revived an issue that's been dormant or even people have considered dead for a very long time.
Sure. As someone who was carless here in this town, I know that having that as an option would have been very useful,
yes.
Being able to kind of navigate that, as I imagine a lot of listeners would also think that that would be a good idea.
Yeah.
As kind of a quick follow-up question, as I have for a lot of these, because they are so contextualized, do you have any type of rough timeline in terms of what we're looking at of when we might see progress on this?
I think we'll know more over the next year or two. That was kind of the window that was projected out on this, but we'll see. It does seem to be a rare issue where there is, some support across party lines in the state legislature.
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, we've seen stuff flounder before. It would be a significant investment of time and resources. We've seen even in, today in states like California, which have pitched this governmentally as a major goal and are much less averse to, spending funds on infrastructure. They have their own real issues there. You've even seen, ostensibly progressive politicians kind of say, oh, whoa, we may not have the resources to build, to build rail, to build this infrastructure. So I think it's a real challenge in North Carolina, which doesn't have nearly that level of infrastructure. Is this going to happen, or are they going to take a look at the eventual price tag and say there's no way?
Yes, we are no stranger to a lack of bipartisan support here in this state.
Yeah, exactly. And for good reason often. But and sometimes the bipartisan support is for terrible things, as we'll get into later.
Absolutely. Well, David, let's go ahead to my favorite part of the city council meetings, which are the public comment section, which typically a lot of juicy things come up. And this Tuesday's meeting was no different to that. So there were a couple comments specifically from folks with Vance Elementary.
Yes.
About some of this bond money. What were some of the points that were being lifted up?
So the city's improving and kind of developing the softball field there. But so interestingly, even though city council appoints the members of the city school board, which is actually kind of unusual in a lot of places, including the county system, those are elected. But even though the city does that, Asheville City Schools is still a separate system. It has its own, it has its own management. It has its own processes and procedures. The city doesn't oversee it. The city, budget is not its budget. So, nonetheless, it's been a big focus lately. And actually two of our topics deal with, to some degree, with that today, as one we'll get into a little later. In this case, this is where some of those city parks and rec bond funds are going. They're going to try to put them here. They're going to try to improve this. But if the city partners with the school on it, there's going to be some sharing of resources.
Yeah.
So, the city parks and rec department might have programs use that occasionally. How is it going to be worked out with the school and its needs? And so really what you had was a parent representing some other people who were there who also parents, Vance Elementary students, saying, look, keep the lines open. We sometimes perceive that there hasn't always been open communication here, but that's going to be necessary going forward. This wasn't a huge controversy right now, but Mayor Manheimer and various other counselors indicate they received a lot of feedback on this. So definitely, I think we'll see going forward if there's, clashes over exactly how those – again, there are limited resources. How are they used? For whom? What communities are they seen as benefiting?
And that equity lens that you spoke of earlier, that continuing to be maintained in all these processes.
We'll see. And that's a big debate, is it? We mentioned earlier with the budget. Is it in that case? Even if you say, hey, these resources are going to traditionally, underserved, whether it's communities or schools or, infrastructure, it's in a matter of, well, how is it done? Who does it benefit? Who has a say in it?
Right.
And those questions I don't think will ever go away.
Well, speaking of another equity issue, redistricting came up, which is a pretty hot topic here.
Yes.
And which you've spoken about here on Asheville FM.
At some length,
At some length. And maybe if you can, for the listeners who are just tuning in, can you provide just a little bit of context in terms of what we're dealing with? Because I don't even know what's going on with the redistricting.
So this is – and that's the problem. A lot of people don't. So this is possibly the biggest issue in city politics right now because it affects everything else.
Yeah.
And the question is, A, will Asheville have an election this year, which generally we're supposed to? And we have to ask that. That's already you're into some interesting territory there. And B, will it use this system of districts passed by the state, which a lot of observers have seen, and given the pattern of our state general assembly, this makes sense. And it clearly does. If you take a single look at the map, breaks up precincts where the African-American vote has been particularly prominent. Right. And increased black voting power has been one of the biggest political stories in the city in the past two cycles. And going into the 2015 election, you had an all-white council. At the end of 2017, you had two African-American members out of six council members and the mayor. And that was the most Asheville seen in three decades. And a lot of this is driven by the fact that Asheville is a very rapidly gentrifying city and an incredibly segregated city, one of the most segregated in the state. And North Carolina, no cities here are great, are great on that front. And that's a problem in many American cities, but it's particularly dire in North Carolina, and it's particularly dire in Asheville, even compared to the rest of North Carolina. So that's kind of driven this political pressure. And The Blade has covered this extensively. Our latest piece up now, Delay and Deny, delves into some of the latest developments. But at every single council meeting this year, you've seen at least one speaker, and often a good deal more, come up and say, look, like, when is the city going to fight this? Because these kind of state laws that try to impose these gerrymandered election systems, they've been tried in other places. They've been tried in Greensboro, Wake County, but those cities fought back very quickly.
And they won. Yeah.
Exactly. The judge took a look at it and threw it out in both cases. And in the meantime, they used the election system before it was tampered with, basically. But Asheville hasn't fought it, and that surprised a lot of observers because the city had ramped up to that. All the members had publicly condemned this step. It's not necessary. It, in some cases, very harshly condemned it as a step to crush the black vote. But then after it was passed last summer, they haven't fought it.
Yeah.
And so there's been more pressure on them. The city has said that they are going to look into fighting. The gerrymandering part of this. But at the last council meeting before this one, Mayor Sam Anheimer said they're not going to fight the delay of election for a year. And that raises a lot of very troubling implications. If the state legislature starts delaying elections for a year, that's very troublesome territory to be in. This issue's been getting more attention lately. We've covered it extensively. Actually did an appearance on the State of Things on WNC, which is a statewide program about this issue. Because it strikes a lot of people as weird when cities – generally Republican legislatures have passed this in cities mostly with Democratic or essentially progressive politicians have fought back. That's not happening in this case. But notably, in this case where there was some bad bipartisanship, in the state Senate, Democrats led by Asheville Senator Terry Van Dyne actually embraced this. Supported this measure, said it was time to put the issue behind us. But like publicly, even the rest of the Democratic delegation, the state representatives actually still publicly opposed it. So there's still like, there's clearly some split in this issue. And it's worth saying some of that political pressure that has been partly, due to an increasingly organized black voter turnout has also raised uncomfortable issues for Asheville's kind of status quo, which is sensibly progressive. Dealing with the city's segregation is not a comfortable issue for plenty of centrist and Democratic and even supposedly liberal and progressive politicians as well. And I think what we're really seeing here is in some of this reluctance is that coming back up. You saw another commenter, Lee Cowart, who's full disclosure, is a local writer who's freelanced for The Blade some before, get up and speak and kind of reiterate, look, we expect you to fight this. There was even a referendum in 2017 where the city put this issue to city voters and city voters before the final bill was passed last year in 2018. But they put basically the idea of do you want the city split into districts, and voters rejected 75-25, which is as much of a landslide as you'll ever get in city politics, basically. So I don't think you're going to see this issue going away. I think it's interesting the drumbeat has continued. It's rare for an issue to be brought up this constantly in public comment. Very rare. And so basically with 75% of the vote, there is a giant pool of voters. And as we said in our latest piece, bluntly, not many things unify Ashevillians on local politics. Standing up to Raleigh does.
Yep.
And so the look of Asheville City Council bowing to Raleigh and giving themselves another year in office the voters didn't give them, that's making a lot of people angry. And I think we're seeing that.
So, David, you said that this is an issue that's not going to go away. And historically, we have seen, this council not speak up and step out on issues such as HB2 and other issues that have come from Raleigh. Do you see them actually taking action? Do you think this will just kind of continue to just be kind of dragged on?
So interestingly, if the city doesn't take action, it's possible a civil rights group could.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing about voting systems. They, as long as they're in place, they can be challenged any time. And what would happen is a civil rights attorney or group would say, look, we are challenging this law on behalf of the voters of Asheville who are affected by it. And mm-hmm. here are some voters who are impacted by it. We'll see. I do think the pressure is definitely building, and it won't be the first time that council has been reluctant to do something. Last year's, push for policing reforms being one of them, but has been forced to vote for it basically when it finally came up to a vote because of political pressure.
Yeah.
Already, council had stayed silent on it for many months, and the public pressure at the last meeting forced a response. So you are clearly seeing some effect. And council, we don't know for certain that this was that issue, but council did mention they had a lengthy closed session at the end of this meeting to discuss an unspecified lawsuit or potential lawsuit. I think it's very likely that the districting issue was at least probably brought up in that.
Well, I think in the spirit, David, of kind of this veneer that is progressive liberalism mm-hmm. here in Asheville, we'd be remiss not to talk about this achievement gap study that
yes.
came out, a year or so after Ian Mance from the Southern Coalition for Social Justice kind of mentioned some of the worst racial disparities
yes.
in traffic stops.
Yes.
And so this meeting was a particularly interesting one that brought together city council members, school board,
yes.
Other educators.
This is a joint meeting that happened the previous week.
That's
yeah.
right. That's right. So I imagine a lot of the listeners may have heard about this, but can you tease it out a little bit more in terms of
sure.
how bad our achievement gap is?
Terrible. So achievement gap is more than worse in the state. But as troublingly, the disciplinary gap is the worst
yep.
in the state.
Yep.
And to give some context, this is the fact that students of color, especially black students, are disciplined for these same offenses more harshly and at a much higher rate than their white counterparts.
And to be super explicit, we're talking about the criminalization of youth of color. We
yes.
are talking about school
push-out. We are talking
about
the school-to-prison pipeline.
That's right.
We are talking about students who, if they were white, would have, received a reprimand or, an internal reprimand or, a stern letter to their parents, maybe, or detention, instead being faced with potential criminalization. This is a massive issue. The school-to-prison pipeline is an endemic issue, and the criminalization of students, especially black and brown students, is a real problem. And we see that in Asheville. The yeah. rates are terrible here. They are the worst. I'll say it again, North Carolina's rates are not good already. There is, the disparities are already horrible across most cities here in this state. They are even worse in Asheville. And so, again, we're seeing this with the way that laws and rules are enforced here.
Yeah.
Last year, Ian Mance, who's an attorney with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, observed, he tracks his data for a living, he and some of the organizations he works with, and they observed that when it came to traffic stops and disparities, our racial disparities are the worst of any major city in the state.
Yeah.
So again, you have Asheville has a massive problem with segregation and bluntly racism. These systems are
and a lot
racist.
Of funding that comes into our schools.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We have one of the highest rates of funding in the state as well. So there's definitely this and you've seen it with, this affects other issues like the tourism boom, for example. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are making money, but it's not very evenly distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Most Ashevillians have seen things get worse, and communities of color, especially Asheville's black communities, have seen things get dramatically worse.
Yeah.
And when we talk about some of these issues coming up again, whether it's the gerrymandering or some of the issues around infrastructure and gentrification, these pressures aren't going away until
right.
they're dealt with.
Right.
So we will keep seeing them come up in issues from, parks and rec to sidewalks to policing to schools. Which I guess is a good segue into how this did come up at this meeting itself. You had a speaker who's a parent of a child who goes to a school in Hawk Creek say that, there have been an increase in school resource officers, which is the starting point for a lot of this criminalization.
Yeah.
The fact that you have things dealt with by law enforcement officers, especially in the local systems, which we can see numerically the disparities a lot of those systems have and a lot of those departments have, dealing with matters in schools. And that is overwhelmingly, we see that criminalizes black students far more than others. And the student raises concern, parent raises concern, because she said, she'd heard about this. She was dismayed by it. She didn't think that this needed to be introduced into schools at all. And there's a very good argument for not introducing militarized police into schools. But she said that she sat down with this officer along with some other parents, and that they had expressed blatantly racist views. They had said that, you know, black students disciplined more because they misbehave more. And that, you know, black residents were arrested more because they were more criminal. And, like, that's blatant racism. And given some of the attitudes we've seen expressed publicly by some members of local law enforcement, sadly, in the last few years, not entirely a surprise either, if that's the case. However, when she started talking more about the location of the school, city officials, you know, Mayor Manheimer said, look, that's a county school. And so the officer you're mentioning is a deputy. Do you talk to the county about it. And that kind of indicates, too, I mean, it's not like Asheville doesn't have, obviously, that city system has problems of its own with kind of, you know, having police in schools. So it's not like the issue doesn't apply here as well.
It's still happening in our backyard.
Yeah, exactly. But I think with what we've seen with those, you know, really daunting, horrible numbers and all the lives and stories that are behind that, like, it's, again, you're seeing this stuff not being dealt with. And so it comes back up and it comes back up again. And it's going to come up again.
I think what's most frustrating for me as a person who does equity work in the community is that on multiple fronts, when we're talking about school pushout, right, and we're talking about the criminalization of youth of color, how challenging it is for black and brown parents to send their kids to school, to a school in which they are aware of these disparities that exist, that you send a kid to a school in which you know many of the teachers will not look like them, and you know that these suspensions and these expulsion rates are as high as they are. Like, it calls the question in my mind, at what point are white folks who are in positions of power actually going to step up and be like, okay, you know, what we are doing is not working. These biases, this implicitness that exists, you know, there's a study of white teachers when they're scanning a room of how often they tend to kind of focus in on students of color. At what point do we actually challenge ourselves and hold up that mirror and be like, okay, this isn't working. We can't keep touting equity. We can't keep saying that we're doing all these things and yet churning out these disparities. State of Black Asheville, you know, that came out in 2010, a new one has recently come out, and the stats are trending downward.
And this started coming out in 2006, to be clear. Right. Like, this project started, you know, over a decade ago.
And they're going down.
The disparities are getting worse.
Yeah, right.
The number's getting worse. Black household wealth has collapsed in the middle of a tourism boom.
The population is approaching single digits.
Yeah, as far as the percent. Which is, you know, made in as well, like, to kind of tie back the redistricting. That's one reason for this impetus. But it's also made the feats of organizing that get out the vote that has really affected local politics is even more impressive that, you know, these communities have reacted with organizing and on many, many, many levels, of which electoral organizing is one.
Yeah.
You know, and these, and really have made these issues kind of break through this veneer, you know, on a lot of different fronts. So, you know, reluctantly often city officials are having to talk about, confront them, or getting dismissed. Last year, Asheville saw the city manager, the city attorney, the police chief all leave or be fired. And all of them left under varying degrees of pressure, especially the police chief. A lot of that was grassroots pressure. And actually kind of brings back, like, when are people going to step up and deal with this? If past experience is any guide, the second they have to and not before. I think what you're going to see is communities in Asheville, people in Asheville, eventually force them to start dealing with it. I don't think, given what I've seen from city council or from the county commissioners, with some very notable exceptions, I don't think you're going to see those institutions as a whole step up in any meaningful way
unless
they're absolutely compelled to, until they absolutely have to, and they think the alternative, as far as political pressure, is even worse.
Well, you know, I will say, for folks who are listening to this interview and thinking about ways that they can support and advocate for real equity, is that, you know, there's a school position open. There are many
about an incredibly important point.
Yeah, there are many opportunities for you to show up, and also thinking about how it shows up within your own family and your own children.
Well, I mean, we're talking exactly, and we're talking about this in the radio now also, because locals show up to these city council meetings. At the very end, they have a time to get up there and raise anything they want to for 3 minutes.
That's right.
And you are seeing locals using that increasingly to say, why aren't we fighting this racist gerrymander? Because it's not, you know, the observation I'm seeing from locals is it doesn't surprise them that, given the issues and the real reluctance by a lot of people on city council within city government to deal with these issues, that they might see some advantage in the electoral system being rigged in a more conservative and wider direction. Even if it's not going to elect Republicans, it might elect, you know, more conservative Democrats who are less averse to acting on these issues. Yeah. So that's what people are saying, and that's a criticism a lot of critics have proffered, and I think there's some real justice behind that. There's some real valid concerns. But that's been raised – and there's been any – the silence over that has been broken because locals have showed up. We're talking about the issue of school resource officers because those numbers that came out, because someone got up and said, look, I'm seeing this in my child's school, and I have real, real problems with this, and you need to be aware of that. And so that's –
we should all have real problems with it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the point. And that was her point too. You know, that we should all have a problem with this. We should get up. We should talk about it. You know, Asheville functions on silence. Yeah. And one way – or Asheville's injustice functions on silence.
Which is complicity.
Yeah. And if you people want that injustice to break, the silence needs to end.
Well, David, outside of those measures that folks can take to get involved, another way of doing so is continue to educate and inform yourself around these issues and so many other issues that you so brilliantly write about. And they can do that by going to
AshevilleBlade.com.
And David, thank you as always. I really enjoyed chatting with you today and look forward to it next time.
My pleasure.
Thanks.